everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. Over the last century or so, bourgeoisie elements in politics, media, and academia have been hard at work slandering the left in an effort to subvert any true understanding of history. They do this by constructing narratives around socialism and communism that lead people to dismiss these terms and what they actually mean, as well as the left movements fighting for a better world. Why is it so important to correct the record? How does it apply to the advancement of left movements today? Joining me to discuss this and more are two guests, Henry Hakamaki and Salvatore Angel Di Mauro, co-translators and editors of Domenico Lasordo's Stalin, History and Critique of a Black Legend. They're also finishing the translation of another book, An Acroecological History of the USSR in Cuba, which will be coming out from ISCRA later this year. Henry Hakamaki is also an educator, activist, co-host of the Guerrilla History podcast, which I was recently a guest on, and an editorial board member of ISCRA Books. Salvatore Angel Di Mauro is a professor in the Geography Department in Environmental Studies at SUNY New Paltz, a senior editor of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, reviews editor at the journal Human Geography, and the author or editor of numerous books, including Socialist States and the Environment. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full interview is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Henry and Salvatore, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be on, Rania.
It is a pleasure to have you on. And we have so much to talk about. And obviously, like, we're going to open with what this episode is centered around. And that is a lot of the lessons in a book that the two of you co-translated and edited. And that is Stalin, History and Critique of a Black Legend. And I know that there's another forthcoming book you guys are working on that will come out, which we will get to. But let's start with the Stalin book, right? Because Stalin is a figure that elicits many feelings in the West, many not good feelings in the West. So let's start with, what is this book about?
Yeah, I think even before we take what this book is about, it might be useful to know a little bit about Domenico Lasordo, who is the author of this book. Salvatore and I translated and edited it and wrote the introduction for it, but it was a book that was written by Lasordo about, what, a decade and a half ago at this point, Salvatore. So I'll pitch it over to you to introduce who Lasordo was, and then I can pick up with the book, I guess.
Sure. Lasordo was a communist activist, party member, actually, of several communist parties in Italy since the 1991 dissolution of the Italian Communist Party, and was a historian, philologist, philosopher who taught at University of Urbino for a long time. And without going into too many details, he contributed many works, especially on philosophy, but also historiography. And so the book that we're discussing was one of several historiographical works that he contributed. He was written about Che Guevara as well, for example, and Lenin. So I'm not sure. I don't think those have been translated to English, and hopefully they will be soon enough. Following with our effort, that is the hope. Anyway, we could start talking about the substance of the book, I reckon, unless there are other aspects of Lasordo that one would want to talk about.
No, I think that we can be brief with Lasordo right now. I'll pick up with the book and feel free, Salvatore, to add in anything that I miss. So when we're talking about the book, Stalin, History and Critique of a Black Legend, inevitably there's going to be some misconceptions about what this book is. The first misconception of what the book is that it's a biography of Stalin, which it is not at all. There's almost nothing biographical about Stalin in here. This is also not an analysis of the Stalin administration as such. Another thing that has been presented online in terms of what this book is some sort of hagiography or a whitewashing of Stalin. Again, if you have opened the book, you will see that that is not the case. So there's a lot of misconceptions about what this book is. And I guess getting some of those things dispelled before we even talk about what it actually is might be helpful. So not a biography, not an analysis of the Stalin administration, and it's not a hagiography of Stalin. So what is it? Well, probably the easiest way to put it is that it's a critical media and narrative analysis of Stalin. When we're talking about narrative analysis, and this is quite important, we have to understand that those of us on the left often have narratives constructed about us and about our movements. And in this book, what Lasurdo is doing is he is demonstrating how this narrative, this black legend, which Salvatore, maybe you can talk about a little bit later, but this black legend, this narrative around Stalin is constructed and how that narrative is then utilized to attack figures, other figures on the left or movements on the left, equating Stalin with every left figure, every left movement. And in many ways, it's a complete uncharitable reading of what happened during the Stalin administration, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more as we get into it. But again, what this is Stalin is really a case study in this book. This book is, while the book is all about Stalin, you know, from beginning to end, you see Stalin on every page. But if you look beneath the surface, and I think that this is obviously the more important and more interesting point, is that since this isn't a biography or an analysis of the Stalin administration, what are we using this book for? It is not to understand Stalin the man, it is to understand how the narrative of Stalin was constructed, how that narrative is utilized by bourgeois elements within society to attack left movements, and by using the example of Stalin, one that is frequently weaponized against the left, we can then begin to understand why these narratives are constructed, how they are utilized, and then begin to combat these sort of falsely constructed narratives.
And that sounds really important. And I want to I want you to elaborate on that shortly. But first, I think that it's really important that that Stalin is the center of this book. And there are so many left figures who've been maligned by imperialist institutions, media, politics, academia. So then why Stalin when choosing a case study? And I recognize somebody else wrote this book, but why focus on Stalin specifically?
Yeah, I'll pick this up, Salvatore, if you don't mind. I'm sure you'll have plenty to add on here. Now, when we're thinking about the selection of Stalin as a case study, because again, this book it's scrutinizing the formation of a black legend narrative, which could be done about other individuals. It could be done again about Che Guevara. It could be done about Mao. It could be done about Lenin, etc. And it has been done. So why Stalin in particular? And that we have to understand why we are using a case study in the first place. So we have to acknowledge that historical figures, irrespective of their political affiliations, can become subject to misrepresentation and manipulation by dominant ideology. And that is the ideology of capital, bourgeois ideology of capital. In this case, the narrative surrounding Stalin has been weaponized by those bourgeois political elements to serve their interests. By analyzing the construction of this sort of narrative, this is really essential for several reasons. The first is that it helps us understand how power structures manipulate historical accounts to maintain their hegemony. And that by critically examining this black legend narrative, which again, the term black legend comes from Italian, Salvatore, if you want to, when you expound on this, take that, you can. But by examining this narrative, we can identify the methods and strategies that are employed by those forces within society to discredit and undermine alternative perspectives. Now, regarding Stalin specifically, we have to recognize that Stalin, like other left figures, has been maligned by imperialist institutions, that he was a significant historical figure who played a crucial role in shaping the political landscape at his time and many other movements around the world. It was not only within the Soviet Union that Stalin was used as a guiding light, something that we've talked about before in other venues. So by deconstructing the narrative surrounding him, we gain a more comprehensive understanding of the actions that were taken by his administration, the decisions that were made by his administration, contextualizing those historically, understanding the forces that were at play that in some cases forced certain decisions to be made, in other cases influenced the creation of certain decisions. This is historical materialism, of course. And then separating fact from fiction. So just the last thing I'll say before I pass it over to Salvatore, when we're looking at Stalin as a case study, some people may, and I know some people have, raised concerns about potential backlash or resistance to this sort of analysis from people just because we are using Stalin, we, Lacerdo, is using Stalin as the case study. But we have to consider the broader implications of this approach and the importance of tackling these complex historical narratives head on. We have to recognize that focusing on a high-profile figure like Stalin can provide a more profound impact on public discourse and understanding, that we have to understand his significance in shaping the course of history, particularly in the context of socialist movements, again, not just in the Soviet Union, but across the globe, makes him a particularly relevant subject for study by those of us on the left, regardless of what you think about Stalin himself. Just understanding the significance of Stalin makes him a particularly useful and important point of study. And that by addressing the narrative surrounding him, we're able to challenge dominant discourse and encourage critical thinking about the nature of power and its manipulation of history. And that by engaging with contentious historical figures allows for a more nuanced examination of underlying power dynamics and ideological conflicts, as well as external forces and internal contradictions that are at play that necessitate or force certain decisions that can be made, which in the abstract look monstrous, but with contextualization, we can begin to understand, even if we don't agree with every single decision. Salvatore?
Right. I mean, there's very little I should like to add, except a little bit about what Lacerdo himself faced when publishing this book, and also anybody who reviewed the book in a positive manner. There was quite a bit of a kerfuffle in Italy about this book. I guess it came out in 2009, 2011, I can't remember now. And Lacerdo was, of course, as would be expected, accused of being Stalinist or being rehabilitating Stalin. But of course, that's exactly the opposite of what he was doing. It was not a rehabilitation as much as a different work altogether, meaning, as already Henry amply described, a critical appraisal of the representation of Stalin as a historical figure. And to return to your original question of why select Stalin, because Stalin elicits, along with figures like Pol Pot, some of the ways in which within the left as well, you have all sorts of accusations and disparagements that are decontextualized, and not to make any intimation that Pol Pot and Stalin are in any way similar, but those are the figures that are usually elicited in order to besmirch any sort of socialist politics or to preempt maybe or to attempt to preempt their popularity. And so there's a lot of stake at the current moment, but there was already also quite a lot of stake in much earlier. In Italy, of course, there's in that context, there's a strong communist movement tradition that with several, as in any country, like several different kinds of communist currents that sometimes are at each other's throats. We have, in addition, the current that a very minor one at the moment anyway, but by Bordiga, one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party. So when Bordiga gets marginalized, Gramsci is taken up. Gramsci's taken up without the Bolshevik component oftentimes. So there's an ideological struggle that is very important in terms of what constitutes legitimate socialism or legitimate forms of communist movements in terms of principles and applications and whatever. So Lasurdo was accused, of course, of rehabilitating Stalin. There was nothing of the sort, but this continues to be a contentious topic in that regard, because there is this kind of almost like an allergic reaction by components of leftist movements, particularly in the European Union and in North America and other settler colonial countries, interestingly enough, like New Zealand and Australia, this kind of allergic reaction to anything that remotely would cast a different light about Stalin than absolute evil. And so in that respect, there's been a convergence for decades between that component of the left and bourgeois ideologues, which is really, unfortunate, because that just not only repeats received black legends, if you like, and I'll expand on that as well in a moment, but it amplifies it even in sectors where that should be like fighting against capitalism. So that's a bit self-undermining. And again, just to reiterate what Henry already was saying, but the issue of the black legend is it comes from at least in the Italian context, something that is associated with the Inquisition, for instance. It's something, or a process, or a person that is enveloped in this kind of mysterious, dark halo, and oftentimes it has implications of very sort of bloodthirsty behavior and things like that. So that's what it's that's what that title refers to. That doesn't really translate so well into English, but that's the context in which it was written, and that would be, I guess, the meaning, I guess, to associate with that title.
I want to jump into dissecting some of the most common weaponized narratives within these bourgeoisie elements that you're talking about when it comes to the left. And I think it's really important to do this because, I mean, as you all know, these narratives are so prevalent that sometimes even people who describe themselves as socialists will perpetuate these narratives about these past figures and what it means about the left. It's like they've been conditioned to just automatically believe this like list of horrible talking points that they've been told to distribute, you know, all around in their political organizing. So let's start, what are some of these talking points and why are they BS, basically?
There's so many. I could start if you like, Henry. One of them, of course, is the issue of labor camps, which is conflated with Gulag, which is really a system of different prisons of various levels of enforcement and isolation, just like in the US. So you have maximum to minimum security. So, but of course, the term Gulag has come to represent almost like death camps, which is inaccurate. It's especially been shown to be inaccurate representation by historians who've actually taken up the archival evidence seriously and have shown that that the system was much more complex. It certainly was brutal in some occasions. Sometimes the brutality of it had to do with conditions in the wider society, not just with respect to the prison system itself. So it's not to deny that it was a very problematic and certainly in terms of basic socialist principles, countervailing of those very principles, and should not be minimized. But at the same time, because it's been taken up to suggest that there was a particular, specific kind of outcome of what a socialist revolution brings, because that's basically what the implication has been, or what has been stated almost outright, then one has to be very careful with those kinds of terms. It is unfortunate that on the left, they're taken up as as some sort of like with some sort of certitude about what it actually was, that system of prisons. The majority of people who lived in that prison system actually were probably, to some extent, depending on circumstances, treated better than most prisoners in the United States over the past 50 years or so. So that's one aspect. I mean, another aspect one could think about is the purges, which certainly occurred. But if people are interested in further study, I would recommend the work of someone who's not exactly into communism at all. In fact, one could even think about him as an anti-communist, and that's J. Arch Getty, who is a serious historian who's actually taken up the task of looking at a lot of the archival material and has shown that, yeah, the purges certainly were awful, but they were not just from the administration. These were also oftentimes coming from below, from regional administrations as well, that pushed well beyond what the Stalin administration was asking for. One also has to look at, you know, the historical conditions under which this happened as well, in which one oftentimes forgets that the USSR had been attacked by 14 countries, including the United States, early on, and was under pressure from much of the industrialized countries thenceforth, and under acts of sabotage. So it's not like this these purges was coming out of nowhere as well. I mean, they went way out of control, but not necessarily because of what the Stalin administration were doing. They were also responding to an actual situation. That doesn't say anything positive about the fact that Stalin did sign off on like tens of thousands of executions, including top-ranking Bolsheviks who suffered the consequences for the most part of these purges. One also has to recognize that he had basically, I mean, Lasurda doesn't put it this way, but I would, that there was basically a civil war within the Bolsheviks that is not unlike what happened after the French Revolution. And so these conflagrations are unfortunate. You know, they're horrific stuff, but they do happen post-revolution. And just to say that, oh, there's just the evil of Stalin, doesn't actually explain anything. It doesn't allow us to understand how to prevent it in future if there is to be, seriously, some sort of socialist revolution. These are aspects of what is at stake by with these kinds of tropes. One other thing, I guess, I could add, and surely, I mean, you know, if you want to, Henry, please add, but is the notion that under the Stalin administration, they had wanton environmental destruction, which is actually, it did happen, but in fact, in balance, it was the net opposite of what people think. And so, again, environmental historians have actually been showing the opposite to have been the tendency. It is very curious, especially coming out of a left from the United States, you know, to think of the Stalin administration that way when they live in a country where, you know, all these sort of leftist movements have achieved so little in terms of environmental protection and still do. So it's, you know, things are not rosy, but they're complex, but they're not to be completely diminished completely dismissed if one really wants to learn about what is feasible in what kind of historical conjuncture, because that's also what is at stake here. You know, it's not just about it's not really about Stalin. It's about what is feasible when, in what circumstances, and understanding, you know, from the past experiences, what happened that was awful, what happened that was actually really good and constructive, and then how to avoid the stuff that is awful. But again, by just focusing on a representation of the or an image of an individual is not very helpful in finding these things out and in trying to grapple with these kinds of problems that did exist and had been exaggerated in the negative sense and continues to be so in the press and repeated on the left.
I'll save the environmental side of things for a little bit later, because I know that we'll be talking about that again soon, talking about the upcoming book that you and I are putting together, Salvatore, right now. You mentioned the civil wars. Lasurdo actually does address this in the book very briefly. He calls it the three civil wars. I'm going to read just a very small tract from this, and then I'm going to address some of the other things that Salvatore said, as well as branch out a little bit. I'll try to be brief. So regarding the three civil wars, Lacerto says, if we, this is on page 88 of the book, by the way, if you pick up the book, you can get the PDF for free on iskrabooks.org. Our publisher is all volunteer run. And they also make every book that they do available for free as a PDF. So you can pick up a physical copy like this, or you can just download the PDF, whatever is more feasible for you. But anyway, page 88, bottom of page 88. If we do not want to remain prisoners of the caricatured portrait of Stalin drawn by Trotsky and by Khrushchev in the course of two different but equally bitter political struggles, we must not lose sight of the fact that the events that began in October 1917 were characterized by three civil wars. The first saw the reported by the Kassari. The second develops from a revolution from above and outside, which, despite some pushes from below from the peasant world, substantially consists in the collectivization of agriculture. The third is that which tears the Bolshevik ruling group apart, which is what Salvatore was referring to. Now, one of the things that I think that we have to do is dispel with this great man of theory narrative, which is something that is often done. In some places, Lacerto does look at it from this perspective, but kind of from the opposite perspective. What I mean by that is that as historical materialists, we understand that a great man of history, theory of looking at how history works or historiographic method is going to leave you really wanting in terms of analytic capacity. We have to understand that all of these movements were powered by mass-led movements. Even if you don't like the person who's at the head of it, there was mass movement from below in basically all of these cases, not just in the case of Stalin, but you know, pick any movement. So looking at it from a great man of history perspective is going to leave you wanting, but bourgeois elements, while looking at their own society from a great man of theory perspective, a great man of history perspective, like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, you know, who freed the slaves? Abraham Lincoln. Of course, no, the emancipation of enslaved peoples was led by the enslaved peoples resisting against their own enslavement. It was only his pen that people pay attention to. That is great man of history theory. Unfortunately, the bourgeois elements of society take the same tract in terms of looking at their perceived enemies, and in this case, Stalin. They perceive Stalin as some all-powerful. He made every single decision. He did every single thing by himself. Every single purged person was personally executed by Stalin's own hand, if not by, you know, if not by gun, then by pen, at least. We also have people who are on the left that also slip into this great man of history theory in terms of Stalin was a great person and everything that happened good in the Soviet Union was because of him. I know when we talk about the environment, Salvatore, I'll probably talk about the afforestation campaigns of the Soviet Union. And some people who are committed socialists or communists and are willing to concede that this environmental policy was extremely successful and it happened largely during the Stalin administration. People who are dogmatic in their support of Stalin will still take a great man of history theory and say, well, it was because of Stalin himself that this campaign took place, not that it was some mass movement that came up. But in terms of narrative, and I'll try to be very brief now because that went on longer than I was intending. I apologize, Rania. But within this book, you can think of many of the narratives that are, you know, accused against Stalin. Salvatore mentioned the purges, mentioned the gulags. Of course, we have the so-called Holodomor. And I don't say so-called because there wasn't a famine. There certainly was. I say that because why are we using a Ukrainian word when there was many regions of the Soviet Union that suffered substantially from this famine, particularly Kazakhstan? Why are we not using a Kazakhstani word for this famine? Why does everybody try to portray it as a genocide against the Ukrainian people and not just a broader social famine that occurred at this period of time? Again, political purposes, we know the answer. We talk about anti-Semitism within this book. Again, Lacerto talks about anti-Semitism, the accusations of anti-Semitism against Stalin. It talks about this perceived alliance with Hitler. It looks at the twin pillars, so-called twin pillars of Hitler and Stalin, this conflation of totalitarianism, the Arendtian theory of, well, totalitarianism is totalitarianism. And while Stalin and Hitler were both totalitarian, and therefore in some way they are related to one another, which of course is a stupid theory. I mean, it's just moronic. But even if we're looking at like Molotov-Ribbentrop, it's not something that was dwelled upon too heavily in the book, but it's something that's talked about within society all the time. Well, why did Stalin sign this pact with Hitler? Again, decontextualizing it from history, not looking at the pressures that were on the Soviet Union, the fact that they were facing invasion, and also not looking at the fact that the other Western powers were doing the exact same thing. In 1933, the UK, France, and Italy signed the Four Powers Pact with Nazi Germany. In 1934, Poland signed the Hitler-Pilsudski Pact. In 1935, the UK signed the Anglo-German Naval Agreement. In 1938, in September, the UK signed the German-British Non-Aggression Pact. December 38, France signed the German-French Non-Aggression Pact, etc., etc., etc. I have many more examples. Why was it only the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939 that's focused on in terms of the so-called alliance with Hitler? That's not to say that, you know, we can just say it was a great idea, but we have to contextualize it. That's something that's done. We contextualize it in terms of what were the external pressures. And then also just look at these other countries that people do not have criticisms for. Why is it that they criticize one, but not the other? It's politics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think all that's so important, but I want to talk a little bit about like why it is now, because devil's advocate, right? I could sit here and say to you, okay, fine. That's great that like you want to talk about all these things that happened in the 30s and 40s and correct the record, but why does it matter now? And I mean, one reason I think that's important, and I want you to elaborate on this, is, you know, when somebody mentions, I mean, this is the whole point, right? Is when somebody mentions socialism or communism, it provokes this automatic attack and then like demands for denunciations of like gulags and purges. And then it changes the conversation from the ideological issue of why we want socialism or communism. I mean, what comes to mind automatically, I don't want to sit here and like credit AOC with being a socialist, because I don't think she actually is. But right, when we all remember when she was running and won her election the first time around, and she made the rounds on like CNN and all these different media outlets, they were all losing it because she was using the word socialist, describing herself as a democratic socialist. When Bernie Sanders was running, same thing, you know, everybody wants to talk about gulags and purges and how could you? And they would like literally be like, how can you call yourself this? Because Stalin, like it was the most cartoonish example of essentially everything you're talking about. I'm not trying to answer my own question here, but I want you to like really explain why. But yeah, like why go back and correct the record on like all these things? Like who cares if we remember a famine being different than it actually was? Why does it matter if capitalist media and academia and these, you know, institutions of empire have this version of history that isn't actually true? What does it like have to do with 2024?
You know, Rania, in go ahead, Salvatore.
I love when that happens.
Well, I wanted to share something that coincidentally I was reading this week, and it's from the collected works of Marx and Engels. I hope that's not too cheesy, but just in terms of, but it just struck me that wow, it's still relevant today. And this is the supplement to numbers 335 and 336 of the Augsburg Allgemeine Zeitung on the commissions of the estates in Prussia. Basically, Marx was, as a journalist, was responding to a lot of nonsense coming from the bourgeois press of the day. This is 1842. And he writes this marvelous paragraph, in my view, like, what makes the press the most powerful lever for promoting culture and the intellectual education of the people is precisely the fact that it transforms the material struggle into an ideological struggle, the struggle of flesh and blood into a struggle of minds, the struggle of need, desire, empiricism into a struggle of theory, of reason, of form.
Wow.
And this is 1842. I was like, he's only got what the importance is. The terrain of ideological struggle, right? It's that's what it's about in a lot of ways. And in the United States, one of the major ways in which any socialist or communist movement have been suppressed is through manipulating the media. And so that also speaks volumes about the importance of your work, actually, Rania. So thank you for doing what you're doing. It's really I don't know, but it's crucial work. It's part of the ideological struggle that you were describing as well. Every time there is any chance for a socialist movement, particularly in a country like the United States, or it could be the UK or France or whatever, anytime you have a socialist movement that is a genuine socialist movement that is making headway politically, you're going to you should expect to have repression, but also a huge emphasis on the ideological component. And so the recent resolution, was it last year, that came out, which was one of the most fascinating, ridiculous resolutions I've read so far from Congress. There are so many, but this one is kind of top 10, in which they had this anti-socialism resolution signed on by many Democratic Party members as well. And, you know, if you look at that, they lump basically everything they can.
I remember this. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm remembering this. I forgot this happened. It's so not such nonsense, but yeah, please continue.
No, it's part of the fear, I suppose, that the ruling classes have of having a popular socialist movement that actually will change things and possibly depose their rule. They're reacting to this, just like the memorial to the 100 million, victims of communism. This is another trope that is bandied about, which I've actually written about myself. And just to show that even if you buy into 100 million, that is a tiny drop of deaths compared to capitalism. But, and in any case, it's based on a fiction.
Because you mentioned this, Salvatore, I just have to note a couple sentences from this resolution.
Oh, great. Yeah,
yeah. February 2023, so this is a little over a year ago, Congress, with many Democrats supporting it, passed a resolution. It's literally called Denouncing the Horrors of Socialism. And then it says, whereas socialism has repeatedly led to famine and mass murders and the killing of over 100 million people worldwide, whereas many of the greatest crimes in history were permitted by socialist ideologues, including Vladimir Lenin, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, Pol Pot, Kim Jong-un, Daniel Ortega, Hugo Chavez, and Nicolas Maduro. And of course, Holodomor is mentioned as well. It goes on to talk about the Great Leap Forward in China. North Korea is bad. Cambodia, oh my God, don't even get us started, you guys. And Cuba, how dare they take land from people? Oh my, it just goes, Venezuela's evil. It just goes on and on and on. And then it quotes James Madison at the end. But I think just noting that resolution was passed in 2023 is very important that you brought that up, just because that is, of course, one way that, like, you see that all of those talking points that you mentioned in a very stupid way are being presented by the most insane, chamber of power in America, which is the U.S. Congress. But please continue.
No, it's just one of many kinds of examples one can draw from within the past decade, and so hence the importance of, in some respects, I mean, relative importance, I should say, of and I'll explain that in a bit, of works like Los Zurdos in terms of countering with empirical evidence and debunking basically all of these charges that are really founded on either exaggerations of certain things that did happen that were wrong, but wildly exaggerated. One instance, for example, the deaths that are supposed to be laid at Stalin personally. Of all the prisoners who died, like in the tens of millions, actually, it's maybe 3 million if you push it, according to the archives. And a lot of those deaths had to do with famines throughout the country that also had to do with World War II in some respects as well. So all of that is completely excised from view. And so I say relative because, you know, it's you know, the media representations, the forces behind these media representations, I mean, are not immune from these debunkings, but they can count on the fact that they control most of the media, and so they have a megaphone, and so it takes additional effort on on people to find things out, to even hear about Los Hurtos work, for example. Mm-hmm. And so again, I come back to the honorable work that you're doing, Rania, in diffusing information to counter these views. It's extremely important. Part of the struggle is with debunking point by point all of these charges. But the other part of the struggle is to gain media prominence and to be able to diffuse the message far and wide, because otherwise it's academics are more or less irrelevant in some respects, without the diffusion of their findings.
Yeah, just to hop in and, Rania, you practically answered the question in your question. You're right on it. And Salvatore, that quote from Marx, who would have guessed that Marx would be on the ball? I never would have thought that his finger would still be on the pulse.
Who's this guy? Who's this guy you guys keep talking about? He sounds kind of interesting.
This Karl Marx guy, I don't know. I used to live in his hometown. That's a story for another day. And of course, now I live in the city where Lenin first went to university. Again, different story.
Vladimir Lenin denounced in the Congress bill denouncing socialism.
Yes, that's right. No, when I say Lenin, of course, I'm not talking about George Lenin. John Lennon. Sorry, God, I can't even get my Beatles right. Okay, sorry. Let's take a step back here and get back to politics where I'm much more at ease. Let's put it that way. Okay, so your question, Rania, was essentially, why are we still talking about Stalin in 2024? Why is this book important? Why are we using Stalin as a case study? Now, that's an excellent question in itself. In terms of, if we want to be moving forward to the future, why are we still trying to take these figures from the past? Well, Stalin himself, and I say this, cards on the table, as a Marxist-Leninist who lives in Russia. Yes, I know, folks, if you just ordered the book when I mentioned it last time, half of you are now returning it. I apologize to my comrades at Iskra. Anytime somebody hears I live in Russia, it's like... But anyway, talking about Stalin, obviously I have an ideological predilection for him, but that is not the point. The point is not that we need to be embracing the figure of Stalin, even though here in Russia, he's still very popular. I will have you know. He's, based on some recent polls, the third most popular political figure in Russia and the Soviet Union's history, behind only Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. Just, FYI. People, he is very popular.
Russians are not
still
watching enough CNN. That's
yeah, right. I mean, who would have thought CNN? If only they would be watching CNN or Radio Free CIA. But in any case, Stalin the figure is not that important. What the reason that we're looking at Stalin is that Stalin is used as a cudgel against the left in 2024. It's not that Stalin was an individual of the left that we have to perfectly emulate. Of course not. Ideologically, I align with Stalin. That's not why I worked on this book. I worked on this book because Stalin is used as a cudgel. A false narrative, in many ways, of Stalin is used as a cudgel. So why are these narratives still being weaponized? Well, weaponized narratives are propagated by the bourgeois elements of society, like I've talked about many times, as a weapon against the left for multiple purposes, including maintaining the status quo, discrediting any progressive ideas. Like you mentioned, Rania, when you mentioned AOC or Bernie Sanders, these people are not my comrades. They're not Marxist-Leninists. But as soon as they say, maybe people shouldn't pay out of pocket for university, Stalin comes up. That's the immediate charge against them, as you are Stalin for trying to make people not have to pay out of pocket for university. As well as, again, perpetuating dominant ideology is the primary reason for using Stalin as a battering ram. These talking points are so pervasive that even individuals who identify as socialists, in some cases knowingly, in some cases unknowingly, perpetuate them. And I think that that's the most worrying thing, is that, you know, we see all of these members of DSA, for example, who are the most willing people to utilize the narrative of Stalin against people to their left, right? That just perpetuates these narratives that are dominant within society. We have to understand why these narratives are problematic for those of us who are in left movements. We have to analyze the common talking points that arise from them and the underlying objectives of these. When we talk about socialism or communism, what are the narratives that we often hear? Socialism leads to economic stagnation and inefficiency. Again, decontextualizing it from any external pressures. If we're talking about Cuba, we are not talking about the blockade. By we, I mean the media in the West. I know I am not in the West and I am not the media, but you know what I mean when I say the collective we. That's the narrative that's in popular society. We don't talk about the blockade on Cuba. We only talk about the fact that there's economic stagnation in Cuba. What, really? I wonder why. You know, Venezuela, same thing. North Korea, same thing. You know, the Soviet Union, they would still claim that there was economic stagnation, despite the fact that if you look at the actual economic metrics of the Soviet Union, the growth in economic efficiency and production exploded once the Soviet Union came in and it, you know, ceased being the Russian Empire. Another narrative that's often weaponized: socialism suppresses individual freedoms, personal liberties. Again, this is something that when it's weaponized, it's often because we think of, again, we, the collective we, in terms of narrative in society. There's great man theory. Stalin himself is choking your freedoms. He himself is ensuring that you don't have the right to speech or the press. Not thinking about societal freedoms, not thinking about freedoms at work, not thinking about freedoms from the shackles of bourgeois capitalist society, imperialist capitalist society. That's exactly. Not even going into the question of settler colonialism, which is a question for, you know, perhaps not right now, but something that absolutely is worth addressing at some point. Another question, or another talking point that comes up: communism results in totalitarian regime. Again, this Hannah Arendtian thinking, which is taken up whole cloth by both liberals and conservatives within the country, and even some of those people that are kind of squishy on the left. Right. This association of socialism and communism with authoritarian rule then allows for an equation with fascism. This, again, overlooks the ideological basis and the desired outcome of these societies in just subsuming any goal that they may have to some perceived authoritarian impulse within that society. Or another narrative: socialism is the same thing as state control. This is a particularly pernicious narrative, again, talking about things like healthcare. Why would the government try to look at, you know, take over healthcare within the country? That is socialism. And if you have socialism, then that's authoritarian. And if you have authoritarian, these narratives feed into one another. So by looking at how left ideology is equated with authoritarianism, it's stripped from any historical context. It exploits the fear of totalitarianism. And in many ways, it capitalizes on generational differences between old and young, and also capitalizes on differences between the global North and global South. Mm-hmm. They, by conflating all of these things and playing these things off one another, they are perpetuating this dominant ideology within society, stemming from the vilification and the narrative building of figures such as Stalin, and probably foremost Stalin. And that's why this work is important in 2024. Not that we're trying to expunge the record of Stalin. Again, I'm a Marxist-Leninist. You don't have to be to find this to be a very interesting or useful work. If you are anywhere on the left and you have heard the term, the name Stalin weaponized against you, or weaponized against any of your movements, or weaponized against any reform or revolutionary tactic that you have been associated with, This book is intended for you.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.